Well, if he's here. Hi, everyone. All five of you. Minus myself. Oh. I've sent him a text, so I hope he'll be here soon. Or at least text me back. True. Okay, well, thank you very much. Well, I'm currently just an undergrad marine biology student at Groningen University in Holland, and I'm about to start my master's degree. And I'm currently setting up an experiment for about a year, and I'm going to test the bleaching susceptibility of corals to different light levels. So that will be my my main interest is marine biology, a little bit of ecology and evolution. So if people want to ask me anything about marine biology, go ahead. And that's about it, I think. But
so in essence, we have Kitch, who is a full-blown nerd, and we have Dutch, who is a nerd in training.
Well, thank you very much, you damn philosopher, you.
Well, at the very least, I'm not focused on spittle of DNA on a freaking Petri dish.
Holy crap.
I will be the one who is going to be relaying any audience questions to the panel here. So if anybody has any questions, be sure to say so in the chat, or if you want to call in, just add Big Lundy onto your Skype, and I will add you into the call.
Please do.
Apparently Goxter has a question.
Oh, nice. Goxter, go ahead. Oh, before he asks the question, I actually have a question for the Kitch. You said you're just an undergrad, but don't you have to do a master's before you can do a PhD? Okay. And how long will this PhD run? That's pretty awesome. So you're going to be Dr. Kitsch 2 in a couple of years.
Dr. Kitsch 2. We will be calling you Dr. Kitsch 2. You need guarantee on that.
Exactly.
I can officially say that I have a PhD on my contact list that I can reference if I have any evolution questions.
Exactly. And if you run into a Nephilim Free, you can say, well, I have a PhD person for you to debate, because he can basically kill every PhD around the world in a debate. So,
this is a PhD just sitting here trying to tell you that you are a dumb fuck.
Exactly. Well, once you get that PhD, you can debate William Lane Craig. William Craig, yeah. Leg.
I don't need to know
what you're talking about to debate him.
You kind of do, because he likes to trick you. And that's kind of his deal, because he does his whole Gish Gallop thing where he makes a crap ton of arguments for his opening, and then if you don't address him in your opening, then he automatically says, well, you know, he didn't address this argument and this argument. So you have to make sure that you have an opening that addresses all the arguments that you know he's going to be making. I've actually talked to DPR Jones about this, and he said that he talked to somebody who did debate him, and apparently what happens is prior to every debate, his representatives come to you and say, well, here's what's going to happen. He's going to start, because he always starts, and he's going to make his arguments, and you can do whatever you want with your opening. And that's essentially what it's going to be. So he sets it up prior to the debate that he's going to be making his arguments before you regardless. So you really don't even have a choice in the matter. It's kind of cheap.
Yeah.
He sets them up specifically so that he can manipulate everybody. It's pretty freaking slimy, in my opinion.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Say that again.
Let's get back to biology.
Yeah.
So can you clear up the DNA is a code hoopla?
Well, there's one above from Organic Beekeeper. How much oxygen is at the bottom of the oceans?
Ah.
Well, that kind of depends on which ocean you look at. I don't know the oceans specifically, but it has a lot to do with currents and upwelling and downwelling of nutrients and that's basically it. You have a lot of oxygen at the top, and if you have a lot of downwelling and what the hell is it called? The giant current in the ocean, the conveyor belt. The conveyor belt brings cold or warm water to the top, so there are some places around the world that have a lot of oxygen at the bottom of the oceans. But it's not a lot. So I don't know if that's satisfying. Yeah. True that. And I remember Nephilim Free making that argument, and he linked to a study, a peer-reviewed study that had the question above it: is DNA a language? And then he said, this paper proves that DNA is a language. And then right there in the abstract it says, so we conclude DNA is not a language. So...
You gotta love me because I made the abstract.
I don't know what's wrong with the guy, but... Yeah. Yeah. Exactly.
I still love Neff's defense as to why he doesn't need to read the whole paper to understand what it says. I can just read the abstract because all the abstract is exactly what you'll find in the paper, just in more detailed language. No, Neff, no.
Not really.
I mean, I
clearly he's never done a thesis.
Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say that clearly he hasn't written any theses.
Yeah.
Theses?
A theses.
TH, not F.
Oh.
Yeah.
Basically.
Yeah. But anyway, I mean, I've written two theses. In both of them, the abstract was not exactly a very accurate summary of the whole thing. So, yeah, exactly. It's like the back of a book.
Sometimes it's not often, but it does happen on a semi-regular basis that an abstract will actually say something contrary to what the whole paper actually concludes. It will say something like, in this paper we're going to be investigating this particular claim, but it won't say whether or not the claim is true or false within the abstract, and then by the end of it says, this claim is either true or false. Yeah. But you have to read the whole paper to do so, but so many people decide, I don't have to, because they investigated the claim. Clearly, that means that they came up with the conclusion that it's right, because I said so.
Well, and
would there be a paper about it?
Yeah.
I don't agree.
Why would they make a
That's
paper?
Not how it works.
I don't agree that you have to read the entire paper, by the way. I think you can do it with reading the abstract first, then check all the pictures, tables, graphs, and then the discussion. That's usually enough to understand the entire, or at least the gist of the paper. If you really want to go into detail,
if you're not really going to question it, you don't really need to look at the method very thoroughly.
Exactly.
You probably should, though, but that's a different question.
You're going to be questioned.
Yeah, of course.
Going back in the chat, we have another question from Organic Beekeeper. Could climate change affect your answer towards oxygen in the ocean?
Well, basically, I just typed in some sort of answer. Because yes, it can. Because if water warms or cools down, it can fuck with the currents. So the Gulf Stream, for instance, is a current that's momentarily still working, but they expect that in the future it might stop bringing warm water to the western shores of Europe. So, and that has to do with climate change, of course.
And then I will freeze my ass off.
I think we all will. Yeah, except for Lundy, of course, because he's a Yank.
Yeah, I'll be fine. We have a nice even climate. It's just going to change a little bit, and it'll just get warmer or a little bit cooler, depending on where you are. It's great here. We're awesome.
Aren't you guys having, like, the worst heat wave ever in America?
It's not that bad, not where I live, at least. I mean, it hasn't reached over 100 on the entire summer. And it sometimes does, so.
Yeah, I don't know what that means, 100.
Oh, 100 Fahrenheit. I think that's, what is that, 30-some degrees Celsius. No, if it was 100 Celsius, I'd be dying right now. Like, literally, I'd be dead.
Yeah, of course.
So,
of course.
I had a question, actually, when we got into this, just in case the audience didn't have any questions or we had any sort of lapse. I've been watching a lot of EvoGen's videos lately, and one of the comments, a lot of the comments on a lot of his videos seem to be confusing alleles with single nucleotide polymorphisms, and he has to re-clarify time and again, an allele is not a single nucleotide polymorphism. So, would you guys mind explaining the difference between the two?
Kitch? I have nothing to add to that, actually. It's a pretty basic description. Okay. Satisfied
with that. Do we have questions from the audience? Doesn't look like it so far. Goxer's still trying to upload his video.
Yeah. But we'll have a woman in a couple of minutes.
Oh, good.
Women always attract a lot of viewers, so yay.
I don't have a woman yet.
Okay.
Well, we might as well troll on over to Goxer's channel and take a look at what he's got for us.
Can we...
Hi, folks.
Can we post this video on Block TV? Or show this video on Block TV? Okay.
Hi, folks. Congratulations, you won. Congratulations, you won.
Apparently. I think I did too.
So I need some help. My neighbor found years ago something on me. Okay.
Well, this is going great.
What the hell are those things? They look like large tusks.
Hi, folks. I need some help. My neighbor found used to do something on the beach. And it's the sea. Those are...
Yeah, they're
help.
Not teeth.
My neighbor found
they're definitely something on the tusks beach. Or horns of
and
some kind.
Well, aren't tusks sea. Teeth, technically?
Those are teeth from...
Well...
No. What?
Yeah, even technically. Well, they don't use them actually to chew food or something, so...
Because I think down there were the teeth... So
I think Womble would be a lot more helpful on that one.
Yeah, I agree.
Somebody knows what this could be, because they have...
I'm not sure.
...on the beach, and yeah...
They seem like tusks to me, but this is coming from a layman, so I'm not sure how reliable that is.
Well, yeah, if he found those on the side of the sea,
pictures of
in Bulgaria he lives, right?
I can
Goxer?
Send you other pictures, so if someone can help us to identify this,
I have no idea. What they can possibly be,
really say what it's
or from
really here about
which animal.
What it is. If it's young, if it's old, is it something of
it
value?
Got me stumped.
Nobody can say it. So I would be happy if you could help me with this.
Weird. I think we'll just have to wait for Womble.
Yeah.
Does anyone have any questions on coral reefs, perhaps?
Can you specify it to something that I know much about?
Exactly. Oh. Are ocean currents the equivalent of weather in the atmosphere, but more stable because of the viscosity? Ooh. That's a hard question.
Kind of.
Well... Weather is kind of treacherous, and it changes by the day, and currents are quite, exactly.
You can say it's the equivalent of climate or weather systems.
I think that's...
But not exactly, but it's comparable.
Yeah.
About an hour.
Great. We have to add Angry Womble to the call, by the way. And still nothing from Sound of Silence.
Oh, there's Womble. So she picks up. Pick up the phone, Womble. There she is.
Hello.
Any questions for a geologist? Hello, Womble.
Hello.
Did you get a chance to look at the video, Womble?
What video?
Goxer's video. He's asking what he found.
Yeah. Check the Block TV.
I'm just going to mute my mic while I watch the video.
Okay.
Well, she does that. A while ago, and people don't know this because I messaged Kitch specifically, and I think he let Martimer know about it as well. There's a guy on a video that EvoGen posted up, Agricultural Transgenics and Jeffrey Smith. He posted like a 7-part comment bunch together, essentially... I don't even know. Like, I'd have to read through this to summarize it real well, and I'm not very good at this kind of stuff. But essentially, he says the bacteria created through GMO foods is infectious to people, and that we shouldn't be using GMO because that's more dangerous biologically if we eat them.
Citation needed.
He also said something along the lines, I think it was this guy, I'm not sure if it was this guy or somebody else, that DNA breaks down in the stomach. Yes, DNA is not broken down in the gastrointestinal tract to the extent formerly believed. Ingested DNA sequences large enough to contain whole genes have remained intact and entered the blood and tissues, is what he said.
No, because you got digestive juices that start breaking it down. It wouldn't be absorbed as a whole protein. It'd be absorbed as amino acids. It's basic biology.
It was physicians and scientists for responsible application of science and technology is what he was quoting there. Or if we were to draw parallel answers in Genesis when it comes to evolution. why do people think... What I'm confused on is why people think citing blatantly biased sources is in any way helpful to their cause. I just don't understand that. And when Marty and you got into it, he immediately pulled the conspiracy card.
And that's when I got out of it.
immediately he went, scientists don't want people to know this. This is suppressed information. And then he linked a video, The World According to Monsanto, where people are forced to quit or fired because of negative findings when studying GMOs. To me, it just sounds like expelled propaganda. What does Scrooge mean? He was like, what does peer review mean? It just means reviewed by other people who are experts in your field. And it was. No, that's not what peer review is.
And it's still open to being questioned. I mean, peer review is necessary but not sufficient. Yeah. Yeah, definitely.
Another question from Organic Beekeeper. Are there significant differences between the biology of deep sea creatures and surface creatures?
Well, I guess that's a question for me then. Well, let me think about that for a couple of seconds. If you can guys keep talking about something else, I'll try and find...
Deep sea fish are uglier.
But
I'm not a biologist.
In fact, well, they definitely are.
I actually opted out of biology class in high school, so...
How dare you?
Have you ever seen anglerfish up close? They are ugly sons of bitches.
Exactly.
A friend of mine has an anglerfish, by the way. It's pretty amazing to see them fish for shrimps or small lobsters or crabs or something. It's quite cool.
Guys, can I just quickly cut in a second? Gox to say he can't hear Kitch.
Thumbs up if you can hear Kitch. If you can't, then just don't do anything. I don't think anybody can hear you, Kitch. They hear me. They don't appear to hear you.
Okay, that's interesting.
Okay, maybe
I
now.
Think they. Right, oh yeah, they can hear me.
Can you hear me now, guys?
Can you hear him now?
Hello. Thumbs up if you can hear me now.
Technical plot problems on Trolling with Logic—the usual thing.
Faintly.
And Sulu isn't even here.
Oh, try it. Ah, there we go.
That's weird.
There we go.
Huh, cool.
You could try speaking a little bit louder because I'm saying it's really faint.
I know. I had it set because the last day I wasn't hosting the Skype call and I was running it off the Skeptic TV. So.
Ah.
So I think I know what was going on.
That's probably, yeah. And he's been saying that for a while, too. I think he said it ever since I asked my first question on, single nucleotide polymorphisms and alleles. So I'm not sure if people heard anything that you said since then.
God damn it. Well, maybe that's a good thing. Maybe I think I was rambling for a little bit during those questions. You can see.
No.
So rambling, in other words,
rambling is
they all know more about biology now than they would have if they had listened to you.
Yes. My talk.
If they just me answer those questions, I would have just confused them more.
You see that?
Oh, crap! Really, Organic Beekeeper? You really didn't hear anything he said?
Didn't hear anything he said? That's awful.
Oh, well, if there's any questions,
When I was just listening to it, I couldn't hear what Kitch was saying. It was just periods of silence, and I was just thinking, is anyone talking?
Oh. You just thought, awkward.
Weird, because here I'm just perfectly fine.
If there's any questions you guys have that you didn't hear the answers to, just post them again, and I will do my best to answer them. I think I'll probably get a better go at them now, because I have a little bit more time to think, and I could refine the answer.
I could fill in the gap very quickly while you repost those questions.
No, we can't hear Womble.
We lost Womble.
She's still on the call, as far as. Oh, there she is.
There she is.
Continue. I feel like this is the Magic Sandwich Show.
I have a slightly wonky USB connection. I've got an old headset, which I'm continuing to use up until the point it completely breaks, and then I'll use my new headset. No, I've just been doing a quick Google search now. It's nothing really conclusive, but it's what I think it's... I've been working on a suspicion that, because it looks like it's tusks, as in elephant tusks, which means it could either be elephants or, as I'm suspecting, woolly mammoths. Because during the last ice age, there was woolly mammoths across Europe. And I've just done a little bit of a Google search, and I found something that indicates that they had woolly mammoths in Serbia, which on the map is literally over the border from Bulgaria. And so it's quite possible it's a woolly mammoth.
Oh, you Google scholar, you.
Yeah, so it's nothing. What I would really suggest to Goxter is if he can take them to a university that's got a paleontology section or something like that, they might be able to have a poke about with them. But I'm thinking it's going to be mammoth tusks. If it's not something that's, as he said, for enough of something else, but without having any geological maps and any, he told me roughly where it was found, any sort of really detailed idea of where it was and what the geology is, I can't really say for definite, but I'm thinking it's going to be mammoth related.
So we've got Womble staking her idea on mammoth. I think I'll go with mammoth too. I was initially going to go with walrus, but something tells me that if it was a walrus, it had to go from one side of the ocean to the other side of the ocean in order to get there. So.
Well, it depends. I mean, we've got fossil evidence of lions in the UK and hippos. So I wouldn't be surprised if it's some sort of relative of an elephant that isn't a mammoth.
That's possible.
So it's possible.
Many died out species to examine.
Well, since the philosopher had a guess, I guess I should come up with something too. And being a sarcastic son of a bitch, I'm going to say it's a Nephilim.
It's a Nephilim.
What part
of the Nephilim would that be exactly? I have no idea.
This would be the toenails, because they never clip the thing.
Yeah, that's very likely.
Those toenails are Nephilim.
I don't know. People may not be familiar with this one, but there are these hoaxed photos of oversized human skeletons that have been going around the internet for like 10 years now.
Long time.
And every now and then you see a creationist claim that they are Nephilim, and in one case it was actually a mammoth, or maybe it was a mastodon. They just added, photoshopped in a human skull, but the rest of the bones were from some elephant-related thing.
Really doesn't fit all that well.
No.
I remember when Neff tried to actually say that all of the giant human bones that have been discovered have all been hidden away in some locked away hidden warehouse like the Ark of the Covenant in Indiana Jones.
Conspiracy! Yay!
You know he believes conspiracies because he actually says as much. He says, here's what happens. See, someone gets on a phone and they call up and they say, hey, patients are trying to figure it out. So what you need to do is you need to take those bones and you need to lock them away. And apparently we're all connected in some huge interconspiracy. We all have each other's phone numbers and we're able to call the higher-ups and say what the people on the internet are saying, I guess. I guess that's how it works in his little mind.
Yeah, well, I suppose I could let you in on it. I was the one who called NASA and informed them about that island thing that they had a video about so and had it taken down, you know, when Neff complained about it. Yeah.
Yeah.
You
see,
bastard.
I loved Coughlin's response when somebody said that he was a part of I think they said that he was a part of the Illuminati, and it was him and the Amazing Atheist, and so Coughlin called up the Amazing Atheist and said, so are you a part of the Illuminati? And he goes, well, see, I'm a level 7, and right now you're a level 5, so, but we don't have access to upper echelons. That's really all you can do with the conspiracy theorists, because there's nothing you can tell them that will convince them otherwise, so you might as well explain.
Exactly.
Yeah, mess with them. That's where all the best fun is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, any other questions for the biologists, or can we move on to others?
Yeah, perhaps some questions I can answer.
What is the most common basic misconception about biology that really grinds your gears?
Ooh.
Interesting.
Gitch?
That's going to take a moment. Obviously, the first one is DNA is a literal code. I've already went into that.
I think I got something.
Yeah, sure. Yep.
That when I mention to other people that I'm a biologist, that they automatically assume that I'm a zoologist and that I know every goddamn animal, plant, bacteria, or something that's out there. And if I can't answer them, they just look at me in disgust. What kind of biologist are you? But, yeah, yeah. I'm a marine biologist, and I'm not a zoologist or, yeah.
That's why I always introduce myself as a biotechnologist, because I know right away that I know nothing about zoology.
Yeah. That's a common misconception with all scientific fields, though. Like, as soon as you said that you're a scientist of anything, they may immediately assume that you're an expert in every single subfield in that particular scientific field. Like, if you're a physicist, then you're supposed to know everything about how the universe came to be, and you're supposed to understand everything about physics that not all physicists know.
I've got the perfect example of this to the extreme. I got into a taxi one day. And the taxi man asked me, oh, what do you do? And I said, oh, I'm a biotechnologist. The next question was, so what do you think of the Higgs boson?
What's your opinion on that Higgs boson, Mr. Biotechnologist? I'd have no freaking clue.
What is the Higgs boson?
Unless you're talking about some different kind of Higgs boson that has to do with DNA, I have no freaking clue what you're talking about.
Yeah.
I say blame the science teachers. Marty, you've got a lot to answer for.
Womble, you're quiet, Womble.
Yeah.
No? I can barely...
Hang on, let me unplug my headset and plug it back in again.
Okay.
Okay.
Any questions on corals, perhaps?
You know what? Yeah. I'm going to have to look up some questions on corals.
Really?
What is your favorite coral and why?
My favorite coral and why? That's kind of a hard question again.
The green one.
No. I don't think I have. I think I have a group of coral that I like very much, which are the Ceratoporas. Yeah, it doesn't mean anything to you, but they have their. Polyps neatly stacked on in a row, so they're not just at random on the coral. So I don't know if Kitch can upload a picture or something for the people to see. Is that possible?
On coral, I'll try and see if there's anything on my Facebook for my diving.
Well, No. I'll try to find the. A picture of Ceratopora hystrix, which is a pretty neat pink coral. It doesn't mean I'm gay, by the way, but it's just...
that was so defensive, I might think that you had latent tendencies.
Pink coral doesn't mean I'm gay.
Let me check.
Is the coral gay, though?
Is the coral gay? Well, no.
Sexual?
I'm sorry?
Is the coral homosexual? Is that why it's pink? So they can attract other like-minded people?
Yeah, I guess
however
so.
However it is that they mate, I don't know.
you weirdos. Those are not questions.
There's a question, though. Are there any vertebrates with more or less than two eyes?
Vertebrates?
Yeah.
Oof.
With more or less than two eyes.
Well, yeah. Of course.
Yes. Two.
Oh no! Let me see. Vertebrates with more with oh. No, I don't think so. I think some of them have some sort of light patch, like flatworms, but. They also have two.
Yeah. I think there have been attempts to make four-eyed vertebrates, but I don't think anybody's actually succeeded so far. I found I found a paper done by Ivan R. Schwab et al., and it's essentially a paper saying evolutionary attempts of four eyes and vertebrates, and I'll go ahead and link that to everybody in the chat room right there. So I don't think that there actually are any at the current moment, but they're attempting.
Yeah, and the only animals that have more than two eyes are arthropods.
And as Dutch said, all you really need to do is read the abstract and then look at all the pretty pictures.
And I'm posting a picture in our chat room, if you can get it up. This one. I don't even know how to pronounce that in English.
I have no clue.
I mean, it's a Latin
word, of course. Seria sepora calendrum.
Yeah, I think that's it. In Dutch, we just say Seria sepora calendrum. So it's kind of the same. I think.
Yeah, Cervato.
Oh, that's pretty.
Sierra Tapora.
It's got like little stickers all over it.
Every time I try to drag it over, it just goes full speed.
I've had to become become adept at pronouncing those sorts of things to a limited extent, with the fact that when I did A-level geology and then the first year my degree, I had to manage talking about fossil names. And I've got lots of echo and feedback.
Because I'm a layman, there's a lot of things that I thought about coral that I immediately had challenged as soon as I had any sort of confrontation about it in real life. And the first thing that I didn't understand about coral is I first thought that coral was made up of dead material. So when I heard that coral can die, I went, I don't even understand how that works. So, you know, how does coral die?
Well, it's I can hear myself double. It's double. Very annoying.
Yeah, I admit that. Bad echo.
Maybe it's the Block TV.
No.
It might be me. My mic might be acting up a little bit.
Okay.
Okay, well, to answer your question, there are a couple of differences between corals. There are reef-building corals which make... they make a skeleton of calcium carbonate, and there are soft corals that don't leave behind a skeleton if they die. And if you talk about the reef-building corals, like the coral I just showed you, the Seria Tapora calendrum, they build a skeleton of calcium carbonate, and they have a small layer of tissue over it. It's basically each polyp is an animal, and they're all in connection with each other, and if all the tissue and all the polyps are gone from the skeleton, then the coral is dead. So even if you still have one polyp on an entire dead skeleton, it's still alive, so to say. Or it can still grow to be another coral. So it's only dead if all the tissue is gone.
Huh. We have another question from Organic Beekeeper. What limits the depth at which corals can grow?
Well, that also depends on... by the way, where did you get this question? So I can't see it on Block TV.
Oh, it's on Block TV. It's in the chat room.
Really?
Yeah, I can see it. Unless you need to refresh.
I think my Block TV just... Oh, holy crap. My Block TV was acting up. Anyway, that kind of depends on which coral you're talking about, if it's photosynthetic or not. If it's photosynthetic, then it depends on how clear the water is, and that's usually until like 20, 30 meters that corals can grow and still can get enough light to get carbohydrates from their zooxanthellae, which are symbionts inside their tissue. Or if you have a coral that's not photosynthetic, they can grow basically pretty much everywhere. But it depends on the amount of plankton that's available and the current of the water. Because a lot of corals have to have a steady current to get the plankton, so to say. They have to be fed constantly or else they'll die. So, and of course, at temperature, salinity, alkalinity, there are a lot of parameters that are quite necessary to be right for certain types of coral. So, I think that's it, basically.
Cool. There's another question that he posted about that. How many types of coral are there?
Well, like I said, there are reef-building corals, there are soft corals, there are photosynthetic, non-photosynthetic, cold water, warm water. It's all kind of different.
And that's not just living ones, because you've also got to remember that there's variations in fossil record that might not be representative of anything that's living now.
Well, I'm not familiar with the fossil record when it comes to corals, but
I'll be honest, I'm not at all. If you want to, the quickest way to put me to sleep is to stick me in a lecture to do with fossils.
Well, let's talk about fossils then.
Oi.
No. This is Ask a Biologist Day.
Yeah.
So, because you keep wanting questions about coral, I'm going to go ahead and I have a lot of questions here actually lined up because I went ahead and looked up some stuff about coral because that's what I do as a person, a part of this panel that is responsible for coming up with questions. So, how does coral disintegrate?
Disintegrate? Do you mean like the skeleton to dissolve?
Yeah, how does that end up happening, especially since it's already in water in the first place?
Well, to dissolve calcium carbonate, you must have a low pH, basically. And that's the problem with climate change, with all the CO2 that's being added to the oceans or being taken up by the oceans. The pH levels are quickly going below 8, and that's kind of like a critical line for calcium carbonate dissolution in water, because if the dissolution rate is below 1, and it doesn't matter what that means, the calcium carbonate will dissolve faster than it can be added by other living creatures. And a coral reef is usually made out of dead coral and calcareous algae, and so that would all dissolve, basically, just by pH. Or there are parrotfish. I don't know if anyone ever heard of that. Parrotfish, they just scrape algae from the rocks, and they also eat the rocks, and they poop them out, and that's why we have white sandy beaches near coral reefs. So it's kind of like a weathering, so to say. And I know I ramble a lot, but it's I can't bring it any clearer.
Okay, Organic Beekeeper had another question from in chat, and they've asked, does carbon dioxide affect coral much?
Well, that's kind of interesting. I just wrote an essay about that, trying to predict the future for coral reefs with climate change. And like I just said, when carbon dioxide dissolves in water, it's kind of tricky. There is a balance of bicarbonate, carbonate, and carbonic acid, and that equilibrium is being shifted by the amount of carbon dioxide, and it basically means that bicarbonate will increase and carbonate will decrease, and they use carbonate for their skeleton. So that also means that the dissolution rate of calcium carbonate will go down, which means that corals will dissolve faster than they can grow, basically. But there are also some adaptations found nowadays in some corals that can maintain a high pH within their tissue. So that means that the skeleton underneath that tissue will not dissolve. But at the feet of the coral, it can still dissolve, and yeah, that's pretty detrimental, of course, for the coral. If the their feet, their structure falls down, so to say.
Collapses.
Yeah, collapses. I don't know. I don't even know what you call the feet. How do you call that?
I'm not too sure what you mean as in roots, maybe, or.
No. Yeah, the base. I think that's the proper way to say it. That if the base dissolves, then pretty much the entire coral will collapse and fall off the reef or between the reef or whatever.
And coral can be quite damaged. It can be damaged, I know, by scuba divers by brushing off them as well.
Yeah, but I think people overreact when it comes to that because they're pretty good at regeneration. So I don't think that's a huge problem, but since there are a lot of scuba divers, it's I can see why it is a problem.
Since we've been lodging a lot of coral questions at Dutch, I figure we can probably lay off for a minute and ask Kitch some questions. I brought up something about GMO foods. you've been studying the whole debate between whether or not we should use GMO foods and all that kind of stuff and whether or not it's safe. So, firstly, do you know what the WHO food safety program is?
The WHO food... I can't say that I'm too familiar with it. But I think I can hedge an educated guess.
They don't appear to be too biased because when I look through their sites, they make many admissions. No allergic effects have been found relative to GMO foods, all that kind of stuff. They tend to be looking at different things and evaluating that it's actually quite safe for anybody who wants to eat GMO products. How is it assessed as to whether or not a GMO product is safe or not? Is that done differently from a traditional food?
As far as I'm aware of, it's the exact same as any other food. Depending on how a GM product's been, as I said, I'm going to make the in this answer, I'm just going to make. It shouldn't really change because you're still eating, you're still ingesting it. It would be the same like any other product. It's not going to be really much different than, you know, it just because a GM doesn't mean it's going to affect, it doesn't mean it's going to do something different that any other toxicity testing won't do. You're still eating a product and it's still going down the normal route, the oral route into the digestive system and then being uptaken by the gut. But I can't think of anything outside of the normal channels of toxicity testing that a GM food taken orally would do. And the only thing I would really, really think of where toxicity testing would change is in the future when we're looking to GM pharmaceuticals. We'll have to do pharmaceutical testing. Especially because some of these, they'll be more stringent when it comes to pharmaceuticals. Hopefully that made sense, but no, it shouldn't change.
Right. I would figure it wouldn't be too much different. There's a lot of, one of the big things that I usually hear is that when someone is a proponent of GMO food, it tends to devolve into a debate about, well, are we playing God with food? Is that really our place to do it? What's your opinion on that whole discussion?
Well, I think it's rather pointless because I'm an atheist.
I mean, you get what I mean, though. I mean,
we're playing nature. We're, we are. I'm going to do a probably a bit more of a controversial statement here. So we are basically, everything in the world is a affects nature. We affect nature. We affect the natural world through our normal habits, through our eating, through our artificial selection, and just conscious and unconscious, we are affecting the environment and causing genetic change and whatnot. Well, not causing genetic mutations, but we're causing genetic drift. Plant evolution, animal evolution, etc., etc. What we're doing essentially in genetics, GM technology, is just speeding that process up, or breaking down some barriers where such things would be either too slow or just not possible because of incompatibilities.
Now, is it true that not all GM crops are made for food? Some are for just plants to try and help the environment in some way?
As far as I'm aware of, GM plants, as far as I'm aware of, are mainly for food. Maybe they'll produce, for example, vitamin A rice. They produce a new vitamin to increase the nutrients. For example, in Asia, rice would be the main diet, and vitamin A was introduced because they don't get much vitamin A in their diet. But you can also have plants that can just grow in conditions where they couldn't usually grow before, drought resistance, increased yield, pest resistance, and herbicide resistance. I haven't heard anything for better to affect climate change, maybe increased CO2 production, CO2 uptake. Maybe, I think that may be to do with increased yield. But I haven't heard anything outside of food and pharmaceutical use. I think that'd be more in the field of synthetic biology, and synthetic biology and microbiology, where you'd be dealing with the environment, such as the breakdown of hazardous compounds. That'd be more microbiology and more to do with bacteria, because they're easier to deal with.
I think we have a lot of promise when it comes to GMO foods, because I just did a quick Google search on all the different conflicts and debates between GMO, and pretty much most of the sites that I'm seeing, both scholarly and not, are essentially saying GMO foods are, on the whole, good, and we should promote them. So I don't think that the whole conspiracy theory people who are against Monsanto and all them are really having as much an effect as they'd like to. I think there's a lot of promise in that area.
Yes, and just to be clear, when Monsanto is a company, just like any other, they're not amoral. They're not moral and they're not immoral. They're amoral. That's why we have regulatory bodies to oversee, to make sure that the products that they produce are safe and that they are fit for market. And they are basically our representatives. I know in the EU and the FDA and the United States, they probably would do things differently, but they do a goddamn good job. Considering how many people have you known, or how many people do you know of, or maybe not personally, but just in general, have gotten sick or died due to GMO technology? None, right? As far as I'm aware of.
As far as I'm aware of, yeah.
So it's just really conspiracy theory. And the main reason why that is because most of the stuff that's transformed into plants are supposed to be good. We take into account that humans will be ingesting these products, so we try to get the plant to produce non-toxic products. When it comes to pest resistance, as I keep on going back to, the model pest resistance gene is the BT toxin, which isn't even active in human gut because it's only active, really, in a high pH gut. In a low pH gut, it's not active because it's not in a, active in a human gut because our pH is low. Otherwise, the reason why that is because when we ingest the toxin, it's in a crystal. It's basically in one big group, and it won't break off and become toxic in low pH, but it will in high pH.
Okay. Yeah, I was just thinking related to that. What exactly is the science behind how we know it's going to, how we think we can be certain to say that it's safe in the future? Because obviously evolution can push things in unexpected directions. So how do we know within reasonable certainty that what we're doing in the future isn't going to cause us any problems?
I'm not too sure what you mean by...
Basically, it's films like... there was a good film that I watched in the 90s where... there was this big plague that was making people sick or making kids sick, and so they released these genetically modified insects to try and deal with it. I mean, I know this is taking things from a film. And then a few years later, there was these problems with these things abducting people, and it turned out the insects... as opposed to having, you know, dying out, some had actually bred, and they really rapidly mutated. Okay. How can we be reasonably sure that, obviously, that's an extreme version of it, that what we've done, that we know that it's safe now, but how do we know that it should stay safe in the future?
By careful planning. That's all I can say. To carefully plan, think of all possible scenarios. But we can't obviously assume that any technology that we have won't turn around and do the Terminator on us, if you want to get into movie analogies. It's just careful planning, just thinking about containment as well, important for GM food and GM products, is containment of the genes into your farm or your wherever you're growing them. And just all the different, when it comes to GMs, it's not just, oh, we'll transform this plant and it's, you know, that's it. There's an awful lot of planning gone into containment, into any ecological issues that might arise. For example, when you're dealing with pest resistance, if you genetically modify your crops to resist those pests, those pests will then evolve, you know, kind of like the antibiotics resistance to that toxin that the plant is producing. So there's actually a couple of strategies to overcome that. So that'd be something that's an example of planning. But yeah, all I can say really is plan, keeping the careful eye out and vigilance. Depending on the crop or depending on your gene.
Cool.
Organic beekeeper had another question. I'll scroll up and take a look at it. Is genetically modified different from transgenic?
Yeah, they're the same. Transgenic would be definitely genetically modified, as far as I'm aware of, my uses of the terms.
Cool.
I think transgenic would, if you have a genetically modified plant, that can involve introducing new genes, which is transgenic, or you can genetically modify the crop through induced mutagenesis, or just getting the crop to, putting the crop or putting the organism into a medium that will higher the mutation rate. And that's actually, our research group actually has published a couple of papers on that, on increasing the mutagenesis rate to evolve a bacteria to reduce a chromium metal. Which is quite an interesting topic that I quite like.
Since we've been railing on GMO for a little while, we'll get back to Dutch and his coral. And so I have more questions for Squirrel. Why is coral important to an ecosystem?
Well, that's a pretty easy question. Fish and coral are dependent on each other. And since approximately a billion people live near coral reefs and depend on fish for their protein, they need to have healthy coral reefs for their fish, for their protein. So basically, if corals die, the fish go away, and a billion people will be left without protein. So that's why corals are very important. And that's it.
Are there, like, any existing problems right now of coral dying out when it really shouldn't be and screwing up ecosystems, or...?
Well, I don't know of any major bleaching events happening at the moment, because I've been on holiday and I've missed a lot of information out there. But what I do know is that there are, I think it's in Australia, where a couple of coral reefs suffer from the crown of thorns. Maybe any one of you have ever heard of it. It's like a giant starfish with a lot of thorns that eat coral. And they've been on the rise in the last couple of years. And they've been attacking coral reefs and eating entire coral reefs. And now it's not a big problem in Australia per se, because they don't depend on the protein from the coral reefs, but just from cattle or something. But I have no idea if the Third World, for instance, has any problems momentarily. So I don't think I can satisfactorily answer that.
Would coral reefs be like a really good argument against young earth creationism? Because I know it takes an extremely long time for them to form sometimes. And there are some that are around right now that are like 6,000, 8,000 years old. So would that help at all?
Well, I usually get a lot of arguments from creationists saying that most coral reefs are only 4,500 years old, and that proves that there was a major catastrophe like 4,500 years ago, and of course they refer to Noah's flood. But I'm not really familiar with the dating mechanisms they use for coral reefs. I actually have no idea. Maybe this is better for Womble to answer, because she knows how to date things like that. Womble.
Yes. So what is it that you're bouncing over to me? The sort of dating of coral reefs or dating of rocks in general?
The question is, how do you date coral reefs?
Yeah.
In terms of fossil or extant ones?
I think extant.
Extant. So, good question. I would say that you are probably, to be honest, it's down to something that's akin to what we call valve counting, and which is basically you can do like a true ring count if you've got a section of coral.
It doesn't ring a bell.
No, I'm just... It's not something I'm massively familiar with. If I was a sedimentologist or paleontologist or paleoecologist or someone that works with paleoclimates, I might be better suited with this. I don't know is the honest answer off the top of my head. I mean, I know that for dating paleo, so fossil ones, you'd look for the nearest volcanic beds or something.
By the way, for those who are watching, good question is code for I'm not sure about the answer, really.
Yeah, it means it's... Translation, this is out of my field of expertise.
So if they have to say good question, then don't expect a very conclusive answer to it, is what I'm saying.
yeah, it means you are challenging even me.
Exactly.
In other words, good question equals ah.
Speaking of Kitch, could you let us know about your current knowledge about homochirality?
You dick.
I am a dick indeed.
Yeah, that's an inside joke. I don't think the people on Block TV will get it.
True.
I'm assuming even that your regular viewers, they would get it.
Yes,
possibly. We've gone over this in shows before.
Okay.
And I know Kitch has at least one video up where he talks about it.
Yeah, but I was calm during that video.
As of that video, you just went, I don't talk about this anymore.
Kitch, what was it that sent you over the edge on that one? Was it Kent Hovind or what was it?
It was Dick Lick.
Dick Lick.
5 Tony VBVB. VBVB?
Exactly.
His name.
I had 2 encounters with him. One in the comments, and then he started PMing me. And then I lost the will to live.
And I think he copy-pastes the PMs, too, because I think he sends the same PMs to everybody.
He sent the exact same to Cal.
I think he messaged both you. He messaged you and Zulu, and you compared PMs, and you're like, this is the same fucking PM.
Yeah, at the same time.
Oh, that kid.
When they do copy-paste PMs like that.
It's akin to spamming. It really is. It's like you might as well be asking to sell something. Anyway, back on to more relevant questions.
Organic beekeeper, I would say yes, but I'll leave that to the team. Oh, he's already answered it.
Well, yeah, but kind of shortly. It's basically that not all the carbon they use is from the atmosphere. So they can't carbon date it. Because a lot of the carbon comes from respiration from other animals or even from the deep sea that's being
hauled
over there.
Yeah, they have access to all the carbon reserves.
Yeah, exactly.
Wouldn't you need to use like separate radiometric dating methods for coral?
The
thing is, to do radiometric dating, what you're looking at is you're looking for the zircon crystals. And zircon crystals form in an igneous environment. They can be altered due to metamorphic processes. If you find a zircon that's been incorporated into a coral and you date it, you will find out the age of that zircon crystal. You won't find out the age of the coral. What you'll get is a case of this coral can be no older than... It's a bit like if I take my driving license and I was to give it to my niece and she was to then start running around with it and you found this driving license on her and it had a date of birth, you could clearly say that it wasn't my niece's driving license, but you could say that they could be no older than the date that my birthday's come from. They're going to be younger than that. If that makes sense. Unless I've just waffled.
Yeah, it makes sense.
I was exposed to lots of sunshine yesterday. I had another question for Dutch here. Is there like an upper limit on the amount of species that can live inside of a coral?
The amount of species that can live inside of a coral? What do you mean?
Is there like a limit? Like how many different species of fish and the like can live inside a coral reef?
Boof. I have no idea. I mean, coral reefs are like the tropical rainforests of the oceans. They're very, very diverse. And it's basically because it's a very oligotrophic environment. There's not a lot of nutrients available, so you have a lot of specialists. And usually, from what I hear from friends who dive a lot, they find like 50 species of fish and small invertebrates inside of a coral, but I have no idea if they ever looked at an upper or lower limit or something, so I don't think I can answer that.
Fair enough.
Congratulations.
Ah, damn it. Stupid freaking congratulations. Fucking ads, I hate them.
Yeah.
How many Since you couldn't answer that one, how about this one? How many different types of animals tend to live within a single coral reef?
How many types of animals? Do you want to hear...
How many kinds?
Oh,
how many kinds?
Well, if you talk about phyla, I think about... How many phyla are there? Like 30-something or something? And I think half of them can be found on coral reefs. So that's arthropods, cnidarians, echinodermata, annelids, chordates, of course, and yeah, I again can't answer that satisfactorily, I think. Mm-hmm. You guys ask hard questions. God damn it.
Oh, that's kind of the point of the panel, isn't it? Ask a biologist.
Yeah, okay, but...
There's like the obvious question. Said, I don't know whether or not someone's already asked it. Where do babies come from?
The stork.
Stork theory is a prominent theory. A lot of evidence backing it up. Mainly anecdotal, but you know.
Exactly. I am making up words. How dare you, Biggs?
Well, that's what scientists do. They make up words and then attribute whatever they don't know to those words. It's sort of like how theists use God. No, I'm just kidding.
What you've just described is how philosophers work.
Oh, snap.
Yeah, exactly.
You're an original scientist.
Of course, if that were at all true, you wouldn't have science. No, I'm just kidding. I don't want to get into this debate now. We'll end up shouting at each other, and we'll be pissed off at each other for a week.
Just accept that you're wrong, and we'll go back to biology. What is the biology that you dislike the most? That if you met that bit first, would make you not be a biologist? Bit of a random question.
No idea.
I can only say that, not really, the theories that I know I quite like, I can't really say that I hate them, any of them. I can only really say, I can say for practical, anything that would turn me off science, really, and this is going at extreme, this is just so I can, I'm only saying this so I can answer it, this isn't going to be at all an honest question, but I would have to say wastewater microbiology. Yeah. Mainly because you have to deal with biosolids, and biosolids basically is shit, and other and other things that can make it through the wastewater treatment process that is solid. That would include shit.
Speaking of shit, 4 years ago I spent 2 years in a laboratory, and it was a medical laboratory, and we had to check for diseases in feces, urine, spit, blood, and I can honestly say I didn't like the feces that much.
No one does.
No. other people's feces. I don't even like my own feces. It's crap.
What's the one bit about your subject area that makes you have the biggest geeky moment? Why should other people be geeked out about biology?
Well, Ard, I'll let you answer that one first.
What, me?
Yeah.
Well, it's. I think the capability of the theory of evolution to predict things, and I think I think that's awesome. I read Your Inner Fish from Neil Shubin. Some time ago, he's the discoverer of the famous Tiktaalik fossil. And using the theory of evolution and a bit of geology, they could predict the place where they would find an intermediate species between fish and tetrapods. And they knew in which layers to look between a certain time frame, and they actually found it. And I think that's like the pinnacle of a good theory, and the theory of evolution is an amazing theory, because a lot of predictions are made with the theory of evolution, and that makes biology, in my field, pretty awesome.
I would have to add to, I would have to say I completely agree. Evolution is awesome, and if you don't agree, you can fuck off. But
exactly.
Yeah, I think I'm just gonna. I could go on about evolution, but I'll just go with something with my own research. People didn't hear it, but I'm doing currently doing my PhD in nanobiotechnology, which is just producing nanomaterials using microbiology. And I think really, there's two I can really say. One, it's not really related to my research because I'm not doing electronics, but maybe one day I will. CDS nanoparticles, quantum dots, that's responsible for, if you have a mobile phone such as an iPhone or a Windows 7 phone, as far as I'm aware of, they're responsible for your display. We can produce CDS nanoparticles using fungi and bacteria. So in years to come, when this technology gains more ground, parts of your phone could be made by microbiology, by microbes, by biology, which I think is really cool. Mainly because I like microbiology a whole lot. And that, and also I'm at the moment coming up with I'm trying to keep the research a little bit sequenced when I start publishing papers, but I'm coming up with a couple of different I'm involved in a field known as nanoantibiotics, which is basically, because of the growing problem with resistance in antibiotics, I'm using nanoparticles to fight bacterial infections. And that is known as nanoantibiotics, obviously. And I just think that is so cool because I can start coming up with cures and therapies for cancer, for bacterial infections, for fungal infections, and really help a lot of people who may be suffering from cancer or a resistant strain of a bacteria, especially when it comes to stuff like cystic fibrosis. And, yeah.
And can I come back to something Big Lundy asked me like 10 minutes ago?
Sure.
He asked me how many species there are on, or how many organisms or kinds are on a coral reef. And I opened my thesis that I wrote a year ago about the Great Barrier Reef, and I found some numbers in there. And the Great Barrier Reef, for instance, it's a pretty big reef. It's the biggest one on the entire Earth. It's stretching for about 1,600 miles, and it harbors approximately 1,500 to 2,000 species of fish, and 150 genera of coral. So that's a lot. But that's basically what I wrote about. And not about any other invertebrates like shrimps or starfish or whatever. So anyway, continue.
That's all I really had to say. I was actually going to say to Aaron Rahaha in the chat if he wanted to call in. To actually,
he left.
Yeah, because I just wasn't keeping up with the chat.
Yeah, apparently... They're after the Magic Sandwich Show.
Which
but
is
they were
on today.
But there is a question from Gibberish 001. Where's the cutoff point between micro and macro evolution?
If
I could chip in as a non-biologist, I would say that there isn't really any, because defining evolution as being micro and macro is a non sequitur, because that's what creationists want you to do. Because it helps fits in the fact that they can turn around and say, well, we accept what they call micro, but not what they call macro, when it's just a moot point.
Using the creationist definitions of micro and macro, I would say that speciation occurs microevolution ceases to be micro when it turns to macro. But however, that barrier keeps on moving and moving and moving. As soon as we prove that each step, speciation and then moving on to a different group, etc., is proven, or at least demonstrated to be possible. And but to be honest, strictly scientifically, there is, and Rumble is 100% bang on.
Well, I actually don't agree with that. Just I was taught on my university that there is a difference between a micro and macro evolution, and that it's a term that's actually being used in science. And a couple of my biologist friends also use the distinction between micro and macro evolution. And it's basically that microevolution is evolution within a species. So if a species has a minor adaptation, but it can still, procreate with the generations before that, macroevolution is just microevolution plus time. So basically what you said, it's speciation.
For me, that it just makes it nonsensical because, you know, evolution is evolution. It doesn't matter what the time scale is. It's just that over long periods of time, you end up with a change in species.
Well, I completely agree that it's exactly the same thing. The mechanisms for micro and macro evolutions are completely the same, but it's just time. And just creationists say there was no time because the Earth is only 6,000 years old. So there wouldn't even be time for macroevolution. So
well, the thing is, with the creationists, they'd then be having what's effectively hyperevolution, as to get all of the diversity that we have today from just the pairings that you have within the Ark is going to involve some pretty crazy, speedy evolutionary processes.
True. Mutation rates that are unbelievably fast, that will probably be lethal.
Well, yeah, I think that the rate, I think someone calculated it, that the rate of mutations would be that new generations couldn't even procreate with the generation before that. So you get a new species almost every generation. And I think that would be especially the case for beetles, since there are about 350,000 species known to mankind.
Yeah, it kind of makes sense when you consider the fact that what creationists are looking for, you know, a new species after a generation, or humans producing new species out of nowhere, or cats producing dogs, or something along those lines. So,
yeah.
At least they're in turn being consistent with their bullshit.
So that's actually what they believe?
Well, for that to be true, that's what would have to have happened.
Yeah.
An insanely high mutation rate.
Yeah. And they actually believe this stuff, but no one can tell which kinds were on the Ark. They can't even define kinds.
No.
So they're
referred to as Barrowmans as well.
Barrowmans?
Barrowman.
Never heard of it. Anyway, are there any more questions from the chat, perhaps?
If anyone has any questions on nanobiotechnology, because that's something I would be definitely able to answer on.
Yeah, or anything on evolution, ecology, or even something on philosophy, physics, or geology.
Or microbiology. Or genetics.
I'm dabbling my toes into the field of planetary science, so you could throw something like that at me. I might be able to answer.
You could, if you want. Where's Lundy when you need him? He's the question master.
Lundy!
Well, if you had to do another science other than biology, what science would you have to be?
Theoretical physics, because of the maths.
Oh, and me, I always wanted to be a paleontologist. Since 1993, after Jurassic Park, I think I was 9 at the time, and then I decided I want to be a scientist and I want to be a paleontologist. I used to call it an archaeologist, but I didn't know any better. But what I meant was a paleontologist.
Yeah, I'm just going to answer a question in chat from CS Bear. It's made from the corpses of dead authors that are getting too cocky with their questions.
Organic Beekeeper has a question as well.
Another one.
Can you use nanos to extract gold from seawater? I'm not sure what you mean by nanos, as in nanoparticles. No, but you can use you can use microorganisms to recover precious metals from... you can use microorganisms to recover precious metals from from water runoff from gold mines or silver mines and stuff like that, because the gold will aggregate into nanoparticles which you can then separate.
I can chip in on that. The problem is gold in ocean waters and general river waters, whilst it's going to be there, it's going to be in such a tiny concentration. You're looking at parts per billion, probably, particularly in ocean water. And as Kitch said, it's to do with whether or not you've got them aggregating. I mean, the reason why you get gold forming in what we call placer deposits is because it's such a dense mineral. And there's a little dip in the riverbed or whatever it is, and so the gold just kind of sits and rests in there, and it kind of aggregates, and then over time it might kind of clump up to form one nugget, as it were, of gold, and then that's when you find it through panning.
Okay. Yeah. And I just wanted to make clear, this is also, my answer was more referring to near streams running near these mines as well, so it would be high because of the runoff from the mine itself. In seawater, definitely not, unless there was a high concentration from a runoff stream. But in normal seawater, it's too low, even for microorganisms.
If I can chip in as well, I can actually, this is pulling in from geology again, I can see a really wonderful, good use of not only with reclaiming precious metals from things like mine runoff, but I could see if you nanobiotechnologist geeky boys that you are could get up to cook up a bunch of bacteria and you know, microscopic microorganisms that mines could have on hand, so that they could deal with things like tailings dams or tailings spillages. And that's where you've got a big sort of mucky, polluted stuff that just ends up bursting through and flooding an area, and it's called a tailing spill. And you have this stuff flooding out into the local waterways and stuff, and it causes a lot of environmental pollution.
What's in this tailing ray?
I was at a festival all day yesterday, so I'm still a bit tired from being out in the sun with that. But tailings is when you've got the mine debris stuff, so the unused kind of like slag or spoilage from a mine. And it's like, if you're mining for certain ores and that, you might find loads of toxic ores or things that are environmental contaminants as unwanted waste material. So you kind of leave that in a big pile, and then you might have water that's related to your mining process, and then if all things go horribly wrong, that water mixes in with that physical wastage, and then it just floods through a riverbed system or something like that, and it causes a lot of pollution.
Okay.
And also
but biology can be possible, I suppose. It can be possible to create organisms that can clean up these toxic spills, such as it can be possible, but I'm not sure.
Yes, I'm sure it's something that you guys could work on at some point in the future. And as well, things like the, I don't know how many people are aware of the fact that there's a lot of problem with some of the well water in India, to do with how it's being affected with arsenic, and there's arsenic poisoning that's building up. Be back in a moment.
Yep, I'm sure with arsenic, arsenic can be removed by, I know certain metals can be removed by microbial remediation, such as uranium actually can be as well, reduced and form nanoparticles, uranium nanoparticles, and I'm trying to think now, iron... Chromium can be reduced into a non-toxic form. And
I think we have another question for Womble, but sure. She just left. There was one from Organic Beekeeper.
The one about the metals.
Why didn't all the heavy metals go to the core? As far as I know,
convection currents.
Mm-hmm. And that
the inside of the Earth is much hotter than the outside, and when materials get heated up, they as a rule of thumb, they get lighter. Their density goes down, so they float up. Then they cool down and go back down. And so it's like when the Earth was molten, it was basically being stirred mm-hmm. by these convection currents. And that's still going on in the mantle.
And
things only fall to the, you know, heavy stuff will only fall to the bottom if there is no stirring motion going on, or, you know, if it's just left to its own. If nothing happens, then all the metals would indeed be at the center of the Earth, but because of the difference in heat, it just doesn't happen.
Uh-oh. Troll on the doll is Aaron Rahahaha.
I don't understand why. I don't understand why he would come in on a different channel, because he's not kicked or banned from the Aaron Ra channel. Or Aaron Ra channel.
I don't know. And we don't have a problem with Aaron Rahahaha. Aaron Rahahaha. So... So, Organic Beekeeper knows who Womble is, obviously, because 2012 is... Well, we're just arguing that 2012 is the best movie ever. The most accurate scientific movie
Fail.
Ever.
You deserve to have volcanoes stuffed up your backside.
I still haven't seen that one, actually.
It will annoy even
don't
you.
Bother.
No. Don't it bother. It will annoy even you.
I can't because stand the 2012 fail. Bullshit, and I can't stand Roland Emmerich. So,
well, bearing in mind they talk about the neutrinos mutating.
What?
Yeah. The Latinos have mutated.
Latinos mutating would make much more sense, but no, the neutrinos have mutated. As Dara O'Brien has said, you might as well say that the electrons are angry. Or the light from the sun has gone off.
Speaking of neutrinos, by the way, to go back to, or slightly off topic, it's not a biologist, but a question from Mortimer. I completely missed that, but the neutrinos that were supposedly going faster than the speed of light, what's the latest news on that? Was it a mistake, or...?
Yeah.
It was a mistake.
There was some... I can't remember exactly what was wrong, but there was some something weird with, I think, the measuring equipment or something that... basically, the only way they found out about it was to repeat the experiment. I think
okay.
It's pretty much agreed upon that it was just a bad measurement because it can't be duplicated.
Okay. So, hey, I see Lundy is back. Lundy, any more questions?
Yeah, sorry about that. I'm dog sitting for somebody, and the dog just got here. I had to go say hey.
No problem.
What questions did you guys go over while I was gone?
Something on nanobiotechnology, I think.
Yeah. Organic Beekeeper asked a question about geology. It said, when the Earth was molten, why didn't all the heavy metals go to the core? The vast majority of the dense material did differentiate down towards the core. That's why we have the solid inner core of iron nickel alloy and the outer liquid core of iron and nickel alloy. the rest of the Earth has got much less percentage of iron and nickel and all the other dense materials. So the Earth did differentiate, but just not 100%.
Okay. So
I was just clarifying something to Troll on the Dole. I wasn't accusing anyone of being a creationist. I was just asking if there was one in the room.
There had
I
been.
I thought there was.
They decided to go.
Anyway, don't feed the Troll on the Dole.
Mm. Don't care. So another question that I have, to get back on this whole question and answer thing.
For who?
For Dutch. For Dutch.
Hey.
Do animals eat coral?
Yes, they do.
Why?
Well, like I said, parrotfish, for instance, they need a large amount. They're huge fish, basically, and they need a lot of algae to survive. And when they don't get the algae from the rocks, which they use their beaks for to scrape them off, they just eat coral, because coral has symbiotic algae in their tissue. So, and like I said, the crown of thorns eats coral, and there are also a lot of butterfly fish that eat coral as well. So it's also used as food for other animals. So yes.
So it's like, it's just like a universal food that they are all able to eat, or what?
Well, not all, but a couple of specialized foragers eat it, and that's basically it. It's not a universal food. I think a universal food will be algae and other animals on a coral reef, and not corals per se, but for a couple of specialists, it is.
So when an animal eats coral, are they being a carnivore or an herbivore?
Well, since corals are plants, Jesus Christ, are animals containing small algae, it's kind of omnivoric, I think, would be the best description, because they eat animal and an algae at the same time. And algae, they're actually protists, but they're closely related to plants. So I think you could say that they're herbivores and carnivores, so omnivores. But it depends on what they actually need, the algae or the tissue. And usually they, in case of the parrotfish, they need the algae. In case of the butterfly fish, they need the tissue, so the animal's tissue. And in case of the crown of thorns, they also need the animal's tissue.
Coolios. Anybody else have any questions, or can I keep going with mine?
Well, I think we have 3 minutes left, so I don't know if...
We started 5 minutes late as well.
Oh, yeah. No, we can. Okay.
Questions. So you said before that you're not sure if there's any actual, like, current danger to coral reefs right now. Are there, like, things put in place to make sure that coral reefs will be protected?
Well, first of all, let me kind of rephrase that. There are problems currently for the coral reefs, of course. It's tourism. It's all sort of anthropogenic stressors, like a nutrient loading. And, of course, climate change. But as far as I know, at the moment, right this moment, none of the coral reefs are actually being affected that heavily that there's, like, a mass die-off or something. But for the future, there are definitely problems. But from what I read, there are building giant water purification plants, for instance, to minimize terrestrial runoff of nutrients. So coral reefs can be overgrown with algae. What are they doing? They're making marine reserves, marine protected areas, where they restrict people from catching fish. And like I said, fish and corals are codependent of each other, or dependent of each other. I think codependent is kind of double. But, yeah. What else can I think of? Not so much. I think, there in Australia, for instance, there's a lot of voluntary work being done to destroy the Crown of Thorns. Because they think it's not a natural disaster that's happening, but it's due to us. The Crown of Thorns are proliferating so enormously at the moment.
Well, if it is due to us and we are natural, then technically it is natural.
Well, yeah.
It's the way in which we do it, though, I think.
I know. That's the difference between natural selection and artificial selection. We're just guiding it along and all that kind of stuff. I know. I'm just making a joke. It's a pedantic joke, but it's the most annoying kind. But, Womble, you wanted to answer a question?
Yes, Organic Beekeeper asked me, it's a really good question, actually, whether or not the moon has an iron core. And it's the reason why it's a really good question. It's not a case of my good question when I was completely out of subject knowledge to answer the question. This is a question that science genuinely doesn't know at the moment. We only ever had 3 seismometers up on the moon, and Nixon decided in a cost-cutting effort in the 70s decided that he'd turn that off. Bearing in mind it took billions and billions of dollars to get those things up on the moon in the first place, he decided he wouldn't sort of maintain the signal so that we could gather this seismic data from the moon. But we only had the 3 seismometers in a triangle formation on the moon. Now, to know what the state of the core of a planetary body is, what you need to have is a big enough explosion on one side of the planet so that you are then sending seismic waves through the entire planet. And from there, you then have seismic devices, seismometers on the other side of the planet, the opposite side of the planet, to the explosion, preferably actually a whole network of them around the planet. And then you can listen to the seismic wave, you can detect the seismic wave arrival times, and then from there you can calculate densities and things like that. There's a lot of work that goes into it, but you can determine the structure of a planetary body that way. And we've done this on planet Earth, so that's how we know about the lithosphere, the asthenosphere, the depths of the mantle, the depth of the inner core and the outer core. There's shadow zones for the different types of seismic waves, and there's repetitions, and there's a lot of kind of clever little stuff that we do to get it done, and we can get a shape of the internal workings of the planet. Now, there's only one thing, and I will have this as a quick pop quiz. Can anyone guess what the one thing is that we've had that's been powerful enough on Earth to send a seismic wave through the entire planet?
A laser pointer. I have no idea.
A super eruption.
Meteor impact?
No. A big enough impact, maybe, but we haven't had a big enough impact on the planet that we felt. Nukes. You set off a nuclear bomb somewhere, bit powerful enough, it's going to make the entire planet ring like the bell. That's how we've been able to determine the Earth's structure, the depth of it. But what we would basically need on the moon is to where we have these lone three little seismometers, we've got thousands on the Earth, is a massive impact on the far side that's really going to make it ring like a bell. And that's the only way we'd be able to say if it had an iron core or not, because the current understanding we have of the origin of the moon is from the giant impact model, and that's where it was originally. The Earth wasn't exactly the Earth, the proto-Earth, and we had a twin called Theia that was about a Mars-sized body, a planetary body, floating in the same similar orbit to us, and those two collided, and Earth absorbed the iron from Theia. And then there was a debris cloud around the Earth, and that re-accreted into the forming of the moon. So the moon is going to be a lot poorer in some things. So we're probably not going to have much of an iron core if it has one. So I hope that answers the question, if it's not just been rambling away on stuff.
What's interesting, though, is that I am looking in my astronomy textbook right now, and it says that the moon does have an iron-rich core, but it's relatively small compared to the moon itself. It doesn't say how we know that, and that's annoying.
Yeah. This is based on one of the lectures I had at the start of my master's degree, that it is current knowledge, currently accepted knowledge, that we do not know if the moon has a core at all, if there is a core, how big it would be, or what state it's in. There is some very deep seismic activity going on within the moon that's not necessarily down to any obvious impacts. This is from all the... We do have a few years of seismic data from these three seismometers. So it's just a case of how much we've got there.
Mm-hmm. Let's see. It mentions here that the Apollo astronauts did detect a very weak magnetic field. So that suggests an iron core. And it also says something else here. The... It doesn't go into details, but the Lunar Prospector probe made some measurements to determine the nature of the core.
Well, you can have the effects of a magnetic core. Magnetic core.
I know there. That doesn't magnetism. Prove it's. Yeah, I know.
And you could have trace magnetism in them. Now you can get magnetism in a magnet by repeatedly striking it. That's one of the ways that you can magnetize a lodestone. Is just repeatedly striking it, or you can get a magnet and you can get it on an iron pin, and you can just keep stroking that steel pin to the point that you've caused the magnetic materials to align to create the magnetic field. So there are a few ways you could get a magnetic field.
Yeah, it does. Like I said, it doesn't go into a lot of detail.
Yeah, the perceived wisdom that I'm aware of. Is that there's no core?
It's pretty recent, though. It's from 2011, so.
So it's
probably new in the
morning. Whatever.
All right. This has been a very educational show, and I'm pretty sure Kitch has a recording of the whole thing. So it should be posted on YouTube relatively soon. So we're going to do a wrap-up because we're approaching the two-hour mark on the thing. Thank you to Dutch Liam and Womble from Skeptic TV for joining us for today.
You're welcome.
Yep, no problem at all.
Thank you to Marty for being here.
No problem.
Thank you to Kitch for hosting for us.
No problem.
And before I sign out, I'd just like to point out to everybody that CS Bear has a video up that his sister needs a lot of help right now financially. She's having a lot of problems. So if you go over to CS Bear's channel, his most recent video is him explaining the whole situation and what you can do to help. So anything will be good.
If you can't help directly in terms of finances, if you can get the word out and see if you know a few people that can chip a little bit in, you know, anyone that can chip in even like a couple of dollars or, you know, $10 or something like that, it's a little bit more than they didn't have to begin with, so any help that can be given would be greatly received by Bear and his family.
Every little bit helps. So, on that, this is Big Lundy. This has been Trolling with Logic. It's great to have you all here. Thanks for watching. Please make sure to subscribe to all of our channels and like and do all that fun stuff and comment and continue the conversations. This has been Trolling with Logic. Thank you very much.
Oh, and just one more thing. Our next show is in 2 weeks, and it's going to be with Trolling the Atheist Experience host, Russell Glazer.
So unfortunately, I will not be here for that. So I hope you guys have fun with that one.
Oh, we will. I hope so. Anyway, thank you guys, and... see you guys next in 2 weeks' time.
Bye-bye. Bye.